This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Last weekend, UCF unfurled a 2017 National Champions banner before its spring game, and players got championship rings. Fans may say the Knights are the real champions after an undefeated run last season, but Alabama won the actual trophy. So does UCF have the right to call its team the champions? We're at 1-866-338-5252, and you can also reach out to us with your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, Knights fans may be celebrating, but the Magic finished a dismal season, and now they're looking for a new coach after firing Frank Vogel. So what does the path ahead look like for the Magic? Meanwhile, the Orlando Solar Bears are gearing up for a key game tonight. It's the first of seven against South Florida rivals the Everblades in the quest for ECHL glory. So is hockey gaining momentum in the City Beautiful? And a mixed start to the season for Orlando City soccer fans, and the Pride have had another hurdle to overcome as well, dwindling crowds. Whether your passion is shooting hoops, chasing a puck around the ice, the beautiful game, or college football, what's your take on the state of sports in Central Florida? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. And we're joined by Jeff Sharon. He's the managing editor of the Black and Gold Banneret, covering UCF sports news. Thank you so much for being with us, Jeff.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
And Ileana Limon Romero is the sports content director at the Orlando Sentinel. Welcome back to Intersection, Ileana.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with UCF undefeated record and how that translates to the championship ring and the Knights' claims of being the real champions of last season. Ileana, just explain this to us for maybe people who haven't been following this story closely. How did Alabama end up with the official trophy anyway?
It's an interesting situation in college football because there isn't an officially sanctioned championship game format, the sort of March Madness that you watch with college basketball. That format doesn't exist for college football. There is a college football playoff, and four teams are invited to participate in the playoff by a selection committee. And they're allowed to play for the College Football Playoff National Championship Trophy. That is the one that is most widely recognized by fans, media, observers of college football as the national title game. However, there are still flaws to the system. UCF was the only team last year that finished with an undefeated record and was not invited to participate in the four-team playoff. The fourth and final team let in was Alabama, and Alabama went on to win the mini-playoff format. They won that championship. So UCF felt, after its win over Auburn in the Peach Bowl, that they were the only team to finish last year with a perfect record. They beat a team in their bowl game that had defeated the other two teams that played for the national championship college football playoff game. So they felt that they had a legitimate claim to saying, look, we finished undefeated. We deserve to be crowned national champions. Mm-hmm. And the NCAA has no mechanism for clarifying this. They recognize more than 50 poll services and different outlets that list a national champion at the end of the year as legitimate national champions. They've sort of stepped away from this and washed their hands in the entire process. There is one group, the Coley Matrix, that has crowned UCF its national champion for last year. It is in NCAA record books listing them as the national champion. So I think the victory parade has annoyed some Alabama fans. They feel like they were rightly the national champions, that they went through the process that is more conventional. But there is a long history in college football of schools declaring themselves national champions after undefeated or close to undefeated seasons. Mm-hmm. NCAA doesn't help clarify it, so there's room to argue.
Jeff Sharon, I mean, the tradition is kind of tied in with football, whether it's college football or the NFL, right? So this notion of teams having to be invited to play for that trophy, any chance of that kind of being switched around?
It's hard to say, but I think the one thing that UCF has done is they have opened up again the discussion that we've had basically for years in college football about whether or not this system actually works and can crown a legitimate champion. Ileana mentioned that, you know, there is a history of teams that aren't the official, quote, consensus national champions claiming national championships for certain years, some of them years after the fact. In fact, mm-hmm. Alabama themselves have claimed three very controversial national championships. One of them that UCF fans like to bring up, and rightfully so, is in 1941 when they finished 9-2 and finished 20th in the final Associated Press poll. They claimed that year that they were a national champion because of a retroactive ranking system.
Okay. So when did the concept of rings, like championship rings, come about? Because do they have a ring from 1940, whatever the year was?
I'm not sure if Alabama does or not, but I think what's happened is that UCF has said, and athletic director Danny White was sort of spearheaded this, was, look, there is precedent. It's been set by the very schools that we're having this argument with. So you know what? We're going to take this and run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has... And I think that the fact that Alabama fans have reacted so fervently in response to UCF claiming a national championship is proof that maybe UCF has a point in what they're trying to say about the system in general. There are now discussions about, you know, kind of getting floated around the college football world about, do we expand the college football playoff from 4 to 8 teams or 16 teams or even 12 teams? How do we invite teams in order to participate in it? Does the NCAA get involved? But right now, those are purely speculative.
Mm-hmm. Ileana, what about other reactions? I mean, is it just Alabama fans who are jumping up and down about the claim from UCF that they are the real champs, or is other teams a little bit miffed by this as well?
No, there are definitely some others. I think those who hail from the traditional, they call them Power Five conferences, sort of the SEC, the ACC, Big Ten, Big 12, Pac-12, they have a sort of a defense mechanism that kicks in when they feel their clout is being questioned. And they argue that they play at a tougher schedule, that they play in tougher conferences during the regular season, and therefore, you know, a 1 or 2 loss season is not the same as an undefeated season for UCF. So mm-hmm. I think there is a little bit of debate. It also helps that there's not a lot of going on right now for college football. So there's a chance to have something that people can truly dig into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a step further than most have taken it. UCF has definitely been aggressive in its embrace of this particular issue, has gone all in. The rings are interesting because they would have gotten rings no matter what for their participation in a bowl game. The NCAA allows every team in college football to get a ring after participating in a bowl, win or lose.
Mm-hmm.
And what you put on the ring is entirely up to you. And so UCF obviously chose to declare them national championship rings, but they would have received a ring for participation in the Peach Bowl no matter what. So it's not a massive change or new expenditure for them. It's something that was anticipated, and that you hope you reach a bowl game at the end of the season, and that's an opportunity to make that purchase. So yes, it has irked some, and UCF fans have stood by their team and have been very proud of being able to get involved in this conversation and share what they think is an unfair system.
Well, if there are some UCF fans out there listening, what are your thoughts here? Or maybe you're not a UCF fan, maybe you're a Gator and you're thinking, what is going on with UCF? Do they deserve that ring? Perhaps not. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We'll be talking about some other sports in a little bit as well. Ileana, just on those rings, I mean, they're kind of complicated things, aren't they? They're quite big, and there seems to be a bit of a tradition of encoding some messages into them sometimes. Wasn't there a case where one team put a certain number of stones in their ring, and that sort of was a way of trolling another team?
Yeah, absolutely. The design of the rings has become certainly something that has become more elaborate over time. I think if you look at the early national championship rings that came about in college football, they're far less elaborate. This is an opportunity to, you know, feature how many wins you've had, how much success you've had. The number of stones definitely acknowledge it. They try to, on a very small surface, acknowledge key points in the season, key points of pride, milestones. And, yeah, Alabama also revealed their championship rings during the weekend, and they did feature a set number of stones to designate how many wins that they've had, how many consecutive wins. And there's just a lot of different things that they try to do and squeeze in acknowledgements within a relatively small, although, yes, very blingy ring.
Mm-hmm. Now, NFL teams paying more attention to the Knights after their last season. We've just gone through some of the draft, and one player got picked up. Jeff Sharon, remind me of the name of that player.
Mike Hughes,
right,
from UCF. He was selected last night in the first round of the draft with the number 30th overall pick.
Mm-hmm. Ileana, I mean, would that have happened, do you think, if UCF hadn't had the winning season it did last season?
That's the interesting thing in the argument from a lot of UCF fans and UCF staff. This has been sustained success for UCF. There was a winless season during George O'Leary's final year 2 years ago. That was tough on the program, but overall, they have consistently produced NFL caliber talent. They've consistently competed for championships and for bowl wins. This is not the first blip on the national radar for them. They were in the Fiesta Bowl a few years ago and won that. They've had first-round NFL draft picks in the past, and it's about the talent they're proud to have developed. It doesn't hurt to be in the state of Florida, where there's rich recruiting territory, and they've developed that reputation. Mike Hughes was someone who transferred in from a junior college right before the start of the season, and he came to UCF in part because it seemed like a good fit, and it was a place where he could develop and get his opportunity to quickly play at the next level, and that came to fruition for him last night. And I think a lot of NFL teams definitely recognize that there is talent and consistently has been talent on this UCF roster. Mike Hughes, three of the last 5 years, UCF has had a pick in the first round of the draft, and they're one of 16 colleges in the country that can say that. So there is a consistent level of talent development that goes even beyond the national championship ring talk.
What about the likes of Shaquem Griffin, for example? I mean, he has a pretty interesting story, but do you think that would have resonated so much had UCF not been doing so well in the last couple of seasons?
I mean, I think it definitely helps elevate his story. The fact that they had an undefeated season and he contributed heavily to it made it palatable for outlets like ESPN to really showcase what he was doing. He was part of the conversation, as his team was part of the conversation each Saturday morning ahead of all of the college football games that were being promoted on the network during their college game day segments. It's a lot easier to tout the talents of an unbelievable player who competes at a high level despite losing one hand as a child when that team is highly successful and really in the mix. I still think he would have gotten national attention. I still think he might have been able to forge a path to the NFL. He would have pushed through in his own way, but the amount of attention, the number of interviews, number of behind-the-scenes videos, and the amount of recognition that he got, and I don't think, obviously, it would have been as high because there was just much more attention surrounding his team and its success.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Sharon, you're watching the draft with interest too. What else can you tell us about some of the players from UCF or elsewhere in Florida who are kind of on the radar of the NFL?
Well, one of the interesting things that we found out last night is the first round of the draft played out. Rounds 2 and 3, by the way, will take place tonight, 4 through 7 tomorrow, is that the state of Florida is, as is usually expected, a real fertile ground for professional football players. 6 of the 32 players who were drafted last night hail from the state of Florida, which is tied for the most with the state of California, which gives you an indication into Florida's prowess. As far as UCF is concerned, in tonight's draft, UCF people are certainly looking forward to Shaquem Griffin possibly getting drafted tonight at some point, if not possibly early tomorrow. Also, Tre'Quan Smith, who is a wide receiver for UCF, had a wonderful season last year for the Knights, may also get drafted tonight. And then there are a couple of other players who may have a shot to get drafted as well in the later rounds. For example, Jordan Akins, who's a 26-year-old graduate from UCF, actually played professional baseball for a time before he turned his attention to football. And then also possibly Aaron Evans, who is an offensive lineman for UCF, may get drafted. So as Ileana mentioned, you know, there's no coincidence there. The UCF has been producing professional level football players for now quite some time.
We're at 1-866-338-5252. If you're watching the fortunes of the UCF Knights, maybe wondering a little bit about how their next season is going to play out, maybe you're cheering them on for getting that championship ring, or you think it's a little bit rich. Perhaps you're thinking Roll Tide and gritting your teeth at the same time. We want to hear from you, 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. What's next for the Knights, Jeff Sharon? Where does their coach go from here?
Well, their new head coach is Josh Heupel, with Scott Frost having left after 2 seasons to go back to his alma mater at the University of Nebraska. Josh Heupel is the new head coach. He's brought in defensive coordinator Randy Shannon, who's also a former head coach, actually previously worked at the University of Florida just prior to coming to UCF as a defensive coordinator. And I think UCF fans are hoping that their next coach goes absolutely nowhere, actually.
They're pretty upset about Scott Frost.
Yeah, it's still quite raw amongst UCF fans. But Josh Heupel actually comes from a very similar background to Scott Frost. He's a former national championship-winning quarterback from a Big 12 school. He went to Oklahoma. He actually coached at Oklahoma previously but was fired as their offensive coordinator a couple years ago. Latched on at Mizzou. And at the University of Missouri, actually turned their offense around. UCF just finished their spring game, and the players universally were saying that, you know, our offense is actually running much faster than it did under Scott Frost. There was a hashtag on social media associated with UCF's offense. It was UCF fast because of how they wanted to run their offense. And so far that has actually borne out. And Heupel has more or less said, look, if it ain't broke, I'm not going to fix it all that much. And so there's still a lot of anticipation surrounding UCF coming up this year. What's the follow-on act going to be? There's a lot of anticipation about that.
One more thing on football. Orlando's getting a new pro football team, and it's the return of Steve Spurrier as well. Kind of an interesting side story there. What kind of appetite is there for pro football here in Orlando?
It's hard to say at this point because, you know, Orlando has had a few professional football teams that have gone by the wayside. Obviously, the Predators in the Arena Football League had a long run of success but are no longer here. Also, in terms of, you know, the outdoor game, we've had the Orlando Thunder as part of the World League of American Football in the early 90s, the Orlando Rage in the XFL in the early 2000s. Fan interest was always a challenge for those franchises. I think that the best opportunity for this new franchise in the league called the Alliance of American Football, it's an 8-team league that's going to start in February of 2019.
Are the rules the same and everything?
There are some subtle rule changes with the AAF that they're still sort of working out. But I think the biggest take, by the way, they're actually going to play in UCF's stadium, in Spectrum Stadium, as opposed to the Citrus Bowl. I think that the biggest thing that they're trying to see is, can this be more of a developmental league rather than its own standalone spring challenger to the NFL, which, you know, we know is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. There's not much room for challenging the NFL. But
they do have better names, though, right? The Rage, the Thunder.
Which, you know, and old Thunder fans would claim better uniforms, too. They used to have these neon green uniforms back in the day. But the hope is that, you know, is that the Orlando AAF franchise might be a good breeding ground for players who maybe are not quite NFL-ready, but certainly have NFL-level talent. And if you can develop that talent, the NFL's been looking for a solid developmental league since the NFL Europe League went away some years ago, and this could be an opportunity for that. We're going to find out who the new franchises are going to be in the AAF in due time and see how the schedule shakes out.
Well, moving on from the oval ball to the round ball, and things aren't working out quite so well for Orlando-based teams there. Eliana Romero, the Orlando Magic, back in 2012, you were writing for the Sentinel, and you wrote that Dwight Howard, you wrote about him being traded to the Lakers. It was kind of the end of an era. That's what you said back in 2012. 5 years on, what's the era been like since then? Could you even call it an era?
Yeah, it's been a bumpy ride for Orlando Magic fans, unquestionably. The ownership has asked these fans to hang in there, to trust that they were going to go through a repair and rebuilding process, that they would have to use some different players, have to go with youth, have to go with some different things to try to be more competitive in the long run. There were going to be some growing pains and some losing seasons. And there was initially some patience for that. That wasn't really a problem. It was understood that when you lose a superstar of that caliber, you lose other key supporting players, you change coaches, there's going to be some challenges. But they have seen other teams struggle, and I look at the Philadelphia 76ers in particular that were perennially terrible at the same time as the Magic, but committed to losing to try to get better draft picks, to try to replenish their talent base. They've done so successfully, and they're now in the NBA playoffs, while the Magic are still trying to get their footing. They've cycled through multiple coaches. They're in the midst of another coaching search, and it's definitely a tough time to be a Magic fan. The hope is that the current leadership, Jeff Weltman is the general manager who's come through, and really director of basketball operations who's come through and said, you know, I took a year to evaluate the team, and now I understand the course that we need to take moving forward. He is poised to take leadership and make this coaching hire, and the hope is this is the last time they are hitting the reset on rebuilding. This is the last time that they'll need to make some of these moves and can start moving up and moving forward.
Do you think the writing was on the wall for Vogel, or is he a bit hard done by being fired at the end of that season?
I think the consensus around the rest of the NBA is that, you know, he had a tough situation. He was dealt a tough hand here in terms of just a tough roster, not one that was traditionally loaded with talent. And he had some players who got injured, significant players who were injured for extended stretches of the season. So the losing record was not terribly surprising. The argument on the other side was that they didn't seem to be progressing and developing. Did he maximize the talent on the roster? He came in and they changed front office leadership. And so if you were not the coach hired by that front office, there's always a chance that they might give you a little bit of time. But then after that, they're going to make a change and select someone who they know will run a system that they're happy with, that they're comfortable with, and who is definitely more in sync with what their mindset is. So he was already going to have a tough time pulling something off and sort of convincing them that he could be the best long-term fit, and the injury issues and other problems certainly didn't help. Mm-hmm. The argument, like I said, on the other side was players didn't get a lot better. They didn't get a lot better from what they had, and if they'd shown improvement, you could argue the other way that he could have stayed.
Mm-hmm. Well, just a couple more sports to get through here real quick. I want to move on to soccer. Ileana, again, the Orlando City soccer team has had a pretty mixed start to the season. You know, they got off to a great start last season, but that didn't translate to success. Is this post-Kaká team kind of got what it takes to get to the playoffs, do you think?
Well, they were another team that started with some early injuries and didn't have their full complement of players in. But since then, they've been on a tremendous roll the last few games. They have won, and they're going out to play at Colorado on Sunday. Dom Dwyer has been a consistent goal scorer for them. He's been everything that they hoped he would be when he was first acquired at the end of last season. And he continues to provide a big spark. They've gotten more of their injured players back. And they're really in a position where we could see them going 5-6 wins in a row at this point, the way the schedule shakes out for them. So they are finding their footing. It was going to take a while. They did not match the hot start of last season, as you mentioned, but that fizzled pretty quickly. And so they are building on something that seems like a more sound foundation. So they have high confidence in what they're going to be able to do long term. They have not hit the brutal part of their schedule against the toughest teams in their conference, but they are doing what they are supposed to do right now, which is winning the ones that are within reason.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to ice hockey. Before we do get to that, Jeff Sharon, let me just run this by you. A comment from a listener here. David writes, UCF are not the champs. They didn't lose a game, but the whole student body looks defeated. Hashtag biggest, not best. Hashtag fake champs. Some fighting words there. Perhaps not a UCF fan.
Yeah, well, I think he's sort of alluding to the attendance that UCF has had, especially in the last couple of years. The attendance really didn't jump up for this team that was undefeated in 2017 until the last couple games of the season against USF and then against Memphis in the American Athletic Championship game. The hope is now that UCF, in the wake of this season, that the attendance will improve. We'll just have to wait until September to see.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the Orlando Solar Bears seven-game series starts tonight against the Everblades. Some great names in that league, too, I got to say. It's part of their quest for ECHL glory. Jeff, way back in the day for college sports, you covered ice hockey. Is Orlando kind of turning into a bit of a hockey town with the success of this team?
I think that with the fragmented nature of sports as it is, I think the Solar Bears have done a very good job of finding the several thousand fans who are really fervent hockey fans that are maybe transplants from up north, come down here to Central Florida, and they've gone after those fans. And we're seeing a little bit. They've had some relatively decent success. They've made the playoffs a couple times in the Kelly Cup playoffs, but this is the first time they've gotten past the first round in franchise history. They get about 6,000 fans a game, and they market hard toward that niche. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that they run into is that they are affiliated with the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Right.
I think if they were affiliated with a team in the South like the Lightning or the Panthers, and you can see those players develop, that would help the Solar Bears' case with the fan base here in Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff Sharon runs the Black and Gold Banneret podcast. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Matthew.
We're also joined by Ileana Limon Romero. She's the sports content director at the Orlando Sentinel. Thanks again for being with us, Ileana.
Thank you.
Up next, traffic's booming at the Orlando International Airport. The airport is expanding, but how will that new terminal change? How will that new terminal change the passenger experience once it's up and running? Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando International Airport is growing. The latest statistics show annual passenger traffic is now up over 45 million. The airport is now the busiest in the state and the 11th busiest in the country. And a new terminal to accommodate the surging passenger numbers is under construction. Greater Orlando Aviation Authority CEO Phil Brown says the booming Central Florida economy is part of the reason for the growth in traffic.
We've been on a pretty substantial increase since 2014, continued to add passengers every month. Since the beginning of 2016, we've virtually had a record every month that we've had passenger statistics recorded. International traffic continues to grow. We have over 6 million international passengers, up more than 39 million domestic passengers. It's, you know, the Central Florida economy is operating on all cylinders. We've got a lot of leisure attractions that people want to come see, plus we're getting more and more business traffic through conventions and trade shows, as well as things that are happening in Medical City and other business activities around the Central Florida.
So with the increase in international travelers, for example, is that because you're adding new airlines, or is it just because existing airlines are putting more passengers through their flights?
It's a combination. One of the things that we've noted for both domestic and international passengers is they have continued to increase the size of aircraft flying into Orlando. So, you know, 15 years ago, you had a lot of regional jets that flew into Orlando. You have very few regional jets now. They're usually wide body if they're coming transatlantic, meaning there are two aisles and there are a lot of folks on there, or they're extended frame narrow body aircraft coming from Latin America. So in the industry we call it increasing the gauge. So they've increased the gauge. Flights don't necessarily increase the number of flights, but the number of passengers coming in continues to grow. Well, we started the piles. We've been clearing and doing the site preparation work. We're driving piles now for the structural foundation. We awarded another large guaranteed maximum price to the Airside construction manager at risk for acquisition of steel, glass, concrete, so that we can get ahead of the purchases on that. So it's moving forward. We expect that the building itself will be finished in the latter part of 2020, and depending on the precise completion date, whether it falls inside or outside of the envelope of the Christmas holidays will determine whether or not we start operations, because we'll have to move airlines down to the south from the North Terminal Complex, and you don't want to do that at the height of the holiday season.
And then, just because, you know, Florida is in a bit of a construction boom, it's not just projects like the Orlando International Airport, also housing is undergoing a bit of a boom at the moment. Do you then have to sort of think about finding the right workers for the job and the demand for that?
That's all a part of the calculus going into getting bids. And, you know, there are certain trades that we're noticing that are short supply. For example, electrical workers seem to be in short supply. And construction in general, the job, construction jobs are increasing. From what I understand, Central Florida has the Orlando Metropolitan Statistical Area has the highest job growth in the state right now. And so we've been booming, adding jobs, and it's not just tourism jobs, but it's construction, tourism, professional services, healthcare. All those have been growing.
So when the terminal is finished, what happens then with existing airlines? Do you move some of them across to the new terminal, or does it just give you scope to open up, you know, brand new carriers in that south terminal?
Now, our plan is to relocate some of the existing airlines to the south. We're working on the details of that and discussions with airlines. You know, the current trajectory on our growth, would suggest that we could be well past 46 million passengers by mid-year this year. The terminal in the north can comfortably accommodate 44, 45 million. So we're going to have to manage very carefully over the next couple of years. If we continue this growth, we could very well be close to capacity on the south terminal when we open up. So our board's authorized us to look at design of a phase two. We're currently working on phase one. We expect to be back to the board in June to discuss what that would look like and what the cost of that would be, because we want to take advantage of the fact that we are growing strongly and not have to turn anybody away.
When you set out on this plan to develop the South Terminal, does the growth you're experiencing now, does that kind of match up what the predictions were back then?
No, I think we've been growing faster than anyone expected, including the airlines. You know, there was a point in time several years ago that some of the airlines didn't think that we were going to grow fast enough or need any of these facilities. And at this point, from a air traffic perspective, we've got plenty of capacity in the air. Our problem right now is not enough gates to accommodate the needs that a lot of the airlines have. And you've seen the entry into the market of some ultra-low-cost carriers. A couple of them have expanded very rapidly in Orlando. Frontier, Spirit, as two examples, have been growing very rapidly, and they have expansion plans that will continue for the next several years. So it gives another alternative for folks that want to fly into Orlando, because they have very low cost on the fares. They have a lot of a la carte options for you that seems to drive some traffic. And the airlines, frankly, all of them have been pretty adept at filling up the planes and running sales when they know that they have excess capacity on their aircraft.
When you look at the access and exits into and out of Orlando International Airport, do you have any concerns about the roads going in and out? Like, are they big enough to accommodate the amount of traffic you're going to get once you have that South Terminal fully up and running?
Well, one of the reasons that we built the South APM project is we knew that we're getting congestion on the roadways entering into the North Terminal complex. So to take some of that load off, we built a project about a mile and a quarter south of the North Terminal complex to allow people to come in from the south and park and take the people mover up to the airport. You know, it's about a 3.25 minute ride up to the terminal from there. That was geared specifically to take some relief off the roadways. But we do have some congestion, particularly when we have peak hours. Over the last week, we've been doing some paving and repaving of the loop roads that go around the North Terminal complex. And so we've had to be careful how we schedule that, the maintenance of traffic plan, because we'll get backups pretty quickly. The fact is, we have a lot of activity in the north, and we need to move more of that to the south if we can. So that's another reason for us to expand.
And you have those cell phone waiting lots too, but not everyone uses them, right? I've noticed sometimes when I'm driving to the airport, there's cars lined up along the side of the road. Is that something you think you can address with some design, or is it that a matter of enforcement?
That's more enforcement. We're looking at options. That is, for us, a cause for concern. We try and work closely with Orlando Police Department because it's not a safe condition. That's why we built the cell lots. We're constructing or beginning construction on a permanent cell lot in the south. We actually have a pretty nice facility in the north that has some amenities and some information on flights. And we're trying to encourage people to use that. But you have some folks that feel more comfortable sitting on the side of the roadway, but that does give us cause for concern. And so we will try and move those off if they're on our property and encourage OPD officers when they're available to move people along as well.
One thing, too, that happened fairly recently at the airport is Uber and other ride-hailing companies now are all in one spot. So what happens in the South Terminal? Do you have something similar planned for those ride-hailing companies?
We don't have a specific designation, but we're learning over time how to best deal with the ride-sharing, and we just changed the locations to the second level for what used to be known as Uber Black or Uber Select. So they're picking up on the second level, and we've got two locations on each side of the airport for that. I think as people get used to that, as Uber drivers get used to that, it'll be better. But we still have an impact on our curb from those vehicles. There's no denying that, but that's, that's to be expected. We will make accommodations for them at ground transportation, and we have a newly designed passenger drop-off area in the south that they'll be able to utilize as well.
Phil Brown, one more thing, if I could. The decision recently to stick with TSA for its security rather than go with private screening, is that something that you might revisit down the track, or is this it for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think we've worked through some contentious issues with TSA. I think we've come to a meeting of the minds on that. We've seen resources provided by TSA. We provided resources. We've had some improvements already. We opened up three additional lanes in our west checkpoint, which was the older part of the building. It was constrained, so that seems to be moving pretty well. We're going to be relocating concessions in the west end of the airport to expand that checkpoint on a permanent basis, and we'll need to do that to accommodate the growth that we see coming forward. And we've got, I think, a good operating relationship with TSA. We're working on plans to incorporate them into our customer service training, which all of us are going to have to refresh on. That's sort of the fundamentals of safety, security, and customer service that we need to focus on in order to retain the passengers that come through Orlando International Airport. So I think we've got a pretty solid working relationship now, a better understanding. We've seen, as I said, resources from Washington to help us. We've had our local congressional delegation facilitate some of that as well. So I don't know that there's any need for it at this point in time. That's certainly always an option in the future, but I think that our current board is satisfied with the progress we've made, and we're going to move forward.
Phil Brown, CEO of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, Orlando-based photographer Jen Cray has taken pictures of performers from Arnie DeFranco to U2.
I prefer to see a band than to shoot a band when they're right at that cusp, when they're just about to make it and they're still hungry for it and they're still excited for it. They haven't yet gotten jaded.
Tales from the Mosh Pit when Intersection continues. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Jen Cray is a concert photographer whose work appears in the Orlando Weekly and other publications. Cray says she got bitten by the photography bug early.
Well, I grew up taking pictures from the time that I was just itty-bitty, and it was a natural thing to combine it with my love of music. So once I kind of realized, probably around high school, college age, that was like a thing, you could actually go and take pictures at concerts, mm-hmm. It's like, how do I do that, you know? So then I just kind of started doing it.
Now, your Instagram feed is interesting because it's kind of like a trip through memory lane of all the bands that have come through Central Florida, pretty much.
Yeah.
And there's a photograph on there which is particularly interesting because it's like right around the time you just got a digital camera. Tell me about that one.
Oh, which one are you talking about? The Strokes? Yeah, that's probably 2004. Yeah, I grew up, shooting on just old 35mm SLRs, hand-me-downs from my dad, my granddad, which posed a bit of a challenge shooting in the lighting conditions mm-hmm. of concerts. So, digital photography was just kind of coming around in those early years of the 2000s. So I got a digital camera, but it was a really cheap little thing. It wasn't even an SLR because I didn't even know those existed yet. I was, get a digital and I'm good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I scored a photo pass for the Strokes. That was one of the first big shows I got a pass for. And this was right at kind of the peak of their popularity. And it was a garbage camera, but I tried to make the settings manual and change whatever I could and make it happen. And I got a couple of shots that I was happy with. But with that camera, I'm very happy with what I got.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and then you discover that they made digital SLRs and started
yes.
getting into that.
Yes, and then I put them on a credit card and I got one. So once I knew that I could take what I knew from 35 millimeter and apply it to digital and then not have the limitations of 24 exposures and one ISO, then I was super excited.
And you started out just as a fan with a camera.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, whatever, you know, certain artists didn't care if you brought cameras in. I shot a lot of Ani DiFranco shows when I was younger because she never seemed to care about photo passes. Although, ironically, the first real photo pass I was ever given was through Ani DiFranco. So that was kind of the beginning of everything.
And did you have a publication to sell the photographs to before you got that pass? Or did you just say, I'm going to get the pass and figure out what happens after that?
You know, that first photo pass, I don't think I did. No, I don't remember how I scored it. I think I was just very honest. This was in 1997 was the first time I got that pass. So even the internet was still pretty new at the time, which is crazy. But I managed to get a hold of, you know, the right person to contact. And I just kind of said, I'm a big fan. I love taking pictures. Can I take pictures at this show? And I scored it. After that, then you had to have a publication that you were connected to. So then I started getting hooked up with that.
So did you grow up in Central Florida?
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in DeLand in Orange City.
What was the music scene like when you were a teenager?
Locally around there, there was a lot of little punk bands, a lot of folk music. I had a lot of friends that were in the folk music scene. So I did a lot of just shooting friends at coffee shops and things like that. But it seems like it's gotten a little bigger since my days back then.
What was the first concert you went to?
First concert ever?
Yeah.
I was 4 years old, and it was Cheap Trick opening up for REO Speedwagon.
Wow.
And my parents took me to it, and I was very, very young, and I think it was too loud for me at the time, and I think I made my parents leave after Cheap Trick because it was just way too loud, which I've since apologized for.
You remember it, though?
I remember seeing, I remember the visuals of it. I remember the crazy guitars with the multiple necks and all of that. I do have a distinct visual of that. I think it was probably at, the Orlando Arena, whatever it was called back in those days.
Oh, the one that got blowing up?
The old one, yeah. But that was my first concert officially. First concert I went to without my parents on my own was Lenny Kravitz with Blind Melon.
The heyday of 90s music.
Yeah. Those were my concert days. Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that your first memory of that concert when you were four, what you remember about is the visuals, and now that's sort of what you take out of...
I mean, never made that connection.
Do you think that had some influence, though? I mean, it sounds like you grew up sort of surrounded by music. Your parents are obviously into it.
Yeah, I guess so. And even shows I went to as a kid, just, you know, little teeny bopper shows at the arena. I remember seeing the photographers getting escorted out and just being like, how do I get down there? How do I do that? And trying to just figure it out.
What are some of the most memorable shows you've been to? I mean, you've been to so many, but what are some that really stick out in your mind?
Oof. Some of the most memorable would probably be ones that are bands that I personally really, really like. I'm a huge White Stripes fan. Anything Jack White does, actually. So the first time I was able to photograph the White Stripes was at Bonnaroo in 2007. No, actually, it was 2005 at Music Midtown. It all gets confused in my head. But it was just, that was huge for me. And that's something I'll never forget. Another show I will never, ever forget was Morrissey. Being a girl growing up in the 80s and 90s, that was huge for me. And that was probably one of the few times I've been kind of starstruck in the photo pit. Just, you know, to me, he's like a god. So that was huge. Lately, I've been seeing a lot of those 80s reunion shows coming through. One that comes to mind, because I just posted a photo of it yesterday, was The Killers. I had shot them very early on, right after their first album, before they got popular. And then I just saw them recently at the Hard Rock, when now, of course, they're huge. The rest of their tour was arena shows. So it's totally different I prefer to see a band than to shoot a band when they're right at that cusp, when they're just about to make it and they're still hungry for it and they're still excited for it. They haven't yet gotten jaded. And on the reunion shows, you know, sometimes those can be fantastic, but sometimes they can also feel a little sad, you know. So I always prefer to catch the band early.
How do you keep your photos fresh? Because I'm sure if you go to a lot of concerts, there must be a little bit of a temptation just to kind of get in the groove and shoot the pictures that you always shoot. Like, how do you find new angles, new perspectives, and make sure that you stay interested and that your audience for the photographs is seeing something new as well?
I think by going to a variety of shows. Like, if I only ever shot, say, punk shows, I would start to get bored.
Mm-hmm.
So I branch out, you know, whether it's big venues, tiny venues. I've recently done some rap shows, which was new for me, and I actually really, really enjoyed, and now I kind of feel a hunger for that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some country shows lately, which, again, is not a genre I'm very familiar with, but I just like to branch out and keep it interesting that way. And again, focus on the audiences. And even the audiences have changed over the years, so you have to get creative with that. You have to deal with people holding their phones up instead of just, you know, losing their minds, you know. So it, all of that has changed.
Do you go to concerts yourself and just leave the camera behind ever?
It's really hard for me. It's really hard. It's rare, too. Maybe about one concert a year will I not bring a camera, and that usually is just either because it was someone I really wanted to see, and sometimes they don't grant photo passes. Some artists just don't do it anymore. Whatever the circumstances, it has to be something I really, really want to see for me to go to it without my camera, because mm-hmm. otherwise I'm shooting it in my head the whole time.
If you're shooting something like a smaller setting, like a more intimate setting, or a folk musician, something acoustic, do you worry about the noise of the shutter?
Yeah, that happens too. I know there was something I did recently that I worried about that. Oh, yeah, Lou Barlow. And it was beautiful. There was only about 50 people there. It was just in a living room, but it was so quiet. And it was just Lou and his guitar telling stories and playing. And I was very concerned about my shutter noise at that particular show. So I would take a few shots and then pause. And there was moments when the song was quiet or the story he was telling was way too intimate for me to interrupt with a shutter speed, with a shutter click.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wouldn't do it. That was just for those of us here in the room. It doesn't need to be documented. I'll shoot the next song.
So how many nights a week are you out taking photos?
It depends. This is kind of a slow week for me. There hasn't been a whole lot happening. But it could be anywhere from a couple of nights a week to five. Last week, I think there was about four or five nights in a row that I was out. Big venues, small venues, all up and down. So it just depends on who's coming through and what sort of strikes me as interesting.
Do you worry about your hearing at all?
I wear earplugs. I didn't at first, but I have started in probably the past maybe 6 or 7 years being very diligent about that, because I've definitely noticed my hearing is not what it used to be. Especially when you're right up against the speakers and the photo pits. So yeah, I'm always right against the stage.
Getting sweated on by the guitar player.
Yeah. The sweat, the beer, the whatever from the audience members. Oh yeah.
Well, Jen Cray, as a photographer, she takes photos for the Orlando Weekly and others. You can find her on Instagram, jen.cray. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Danielle Pryor answered the phones. You can find previous episodes of Intersection on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. We're on the NPR One app, and you can download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. If you appreciate the kind of in-depth news and interviews you hear on Intersection, consider a gift of support during our Spring Silent Drive. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to our website, wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me over on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Give the station a follow too at WMFE Orlando. Thanks for listening.